Jack Kornfield gave this story at this retreat I just taught about Ruth Dennison, who's probably is the most senior Vipassana teacher in America. She's been teaching Vipassana here in this country about 25 years, and she's an old, that's the right word, elderly. What? She's not that old?
She's not that old.
What?
Mature.
She's getting up there. She must be close to 80, maybe?
No, she's 71.
That's all? 71?
She had her 70th birthday last.
Oh, really? Oh, she's a young lady.
Oh, well, she's wise.
She's wise. Anyway, when I was in Burma practicing there, her husband, who she was separated from, was visiting, and he was in his 70s. Maybe he was 71 then. This was almost 10 years ago. And he was called Henry Strong Dennison. And he was probably the tallest and strongest man in Burma. and they're separated, and now he has Alzheimer's and is losing his mind. He still lives alone. And so Jack Kornfield was telling a story about how it is for him, and how he's burned down half of his house making tea one day, and all kinds of terrible things. And that Ruth Dennison lives about four hours away from him in the desert, and is his primary caretaker, so comes into Los Angeles regularly to take care of him. And I guess spent a period of time taking care of him a lot and was totally exhausted. And then apparently got on the plane one day, and then after taking care of her husband to go teach in Oregon, and got off the plane and showed up in this big hall. Jack says there was 150 people there, hear her give an evening Dharma talk. And so she started speaking and started talking about her husband, Alzheimer, and how difficult it was to take care of him and his story, you know, what was going on with him. And so she talked about that for a while, and then talked about how the Dharma is what's actually happening, and this is what's happening. And so she talked about it some more. And then she stopped and said, "Wait, have I told you yet about my husband?" And started telling the story over again about how it was with him. And then it went on, and then she talked a little bit about the Dharma as what's happening. And then a third time she said, "Oh, have I told you about my husband?" At which point a number of people who had shown up to check her out started getting up to walk out the door, and, you know, didn't want to hang out for this woman who was, you know. At which point, as people were getting up to leave and kind of walk out on her talk, because she was this old woman kind of just repeating herself, she apparently yelled out "stop" to those people and said, "What do you expect coming here today?" And that kind of stopped them. And then she said, you're witnessing a very rare event. And you are seeing a senior American Dharma teacher fail." And so some of them then sat down for the rest of the talk, and some of them still left. But I tell a story because someone asked me, I guess Louise asked me for us to do metta for her cat who's sick, and we want the cat to recover. And I failed because I wasn't in the mood exactly. I sat there doing metta for your cat. But I came late, and I was having kind of car trouble. Up on dark, forested road up on Skyline, and far from anywhere. And I just barely got here. So we can all kind of maybe think good thoughts for Louise's cat and for Louise. So, and boy, what a trip it is coming here late. I had no idea. Have you seen what goes on out there on the street? I mean, it goes, boy, we should carpool or something. What do the neighbors think? And how do you find your shoes out there? So on this Saturday, we're having a one-day sitting in Unitarian Church for people who've had experience meditating, because there won't be any really instructions. It'll just be a day of silence. It'll be like a cross-section of a longer retreat. A lot of silence. And from 8:30 to 5. And then the other thing is, December 25th falls on a Monday. And I was wondering when we should do that Monday. And I was thinking that it might be nice to have our meeting anyway, even though probably a lot of people won't come. Partly because the evening of the 25th is a time when a lot of people, it's all over, right? And it might be a relief to come here. But I was wondering, how many people think they might come on the 25th of December? So I think that's plenty worth it then. So we'll have something here. And any other announcements? Yes?
The Hotel de Zinc, we still need some volunteers to cook for next week, and that would be the last week, because on Christmas Day, there is a church in Palo Alto that sponsors all the homeless, and they have a big party for them. So we only have 3 Mondays this December to cook for. So there's a big green board out in front, here by the food, and you can sign your name up to volunteer for main dish or side dish or dessert, whatever. And if you write clearly and put your phone number on there, please, I might need to call you in case something happens. For those people that have brought food tonight, the dishes won't be available until after the people eat. So that would be sometime after, I guess, 10 or so.
The dishes? You mean, oh, to take them home again?
Yes, the dishes that they brought the food in. So hopefully they will be available tomorrow morning if you can't stay and spend some time with the people. Or I'll see what I can do about getting them here next week if you can't come pick them up. I'm not sure exactly that process. Didn't seem to be a problem last year. So somehow they find their way back to us. But I wouldn't bring good dishes if you're volunteering next week or the week after. I guess there's 2 more weeks.
Sarah,
yeah.
If we come tomorrow to pick up the dish, would we come in here or in the kitchen?
I'm not sure.
Oh. And would the room be locked?
The room is open in early in the morning because the people are still here in the morning. I think they leave at 8, so you'd come before then or get a key. Thank you.
Yes.
We're still paying off our new PA system. Yeah. So we've got about $180 collected. We have about $40 to go for completion. So we have a blonde basket back here. So thanks everybody for your contributions. $40 to go.
Great. It's a nice thing. It's nice to have. I feel more relaxed with, like, you know, I can whisper and you all hear me, maybe. Yes, Rainbow.
I feel troubled.
Oh, this is a standard policy in the whole American Vipassana culture, and maybe Buddhist culture in general in America. And the standard policy is that we have to say it over and over again, because even I have now, I don't have that kind of watch, but it's easy to forget. But and if you're hard of hearing, you don't even know that your watch is going off. But it's always important to check your digital watch before you go to a meditation hall and make sure that it's off. And that's gratefully appreciated by the countless innumerable beings. Yes?
Oh, I'm going to be looking for a roommate to share my place sometime in January. So if anybody's looking for a place or knows of anybody that is, just see me afterwards.
Yes.
I have another benefit event for the Zen Hospice Project to announce. This is an evening with Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg in San Francisco on Thursday, January 11th. The topic is bringing compassion to the world. There are flyers up on the table.
So yesterday ended the 2 weeks, 16 days, 17 days, depending how you counted, retreat that we had up in San Rafael at the Dominican College there. And I told you a little bit about it at the beginning of it, 2 weeks ago. And it's one of the great pleasures for me as a practitioner and as a student, as a teacher, to be present teaching and just to be present for especially longer retreats where there's so much dedication that goes into the spiritual practice of mindfulness and presence, and to see how people unfold in the course of the retreat. And one of the things that you see is that at the beginning of a longer retreat, there tends to be a lot of struggle. And by the end of the retreat, there's very little struggle left, or there's much more peace and equanimity and self-acceptance. And one of the things, there's many benefits to a longer retreat, but one of the things that you see on a longer retreat is you can see very clearly the consequences of the effort and the intention you bring to your meditation practice. When you meditate at home every day for half an hour or 40 minutes or whatever you might sit at home for, you might have certain attitude about your meditation, about what you want to get from it or what you're supposed to do and how much effort you're supposed to make. And if you're only sitting for half an hour or 40 minutes, then mostly what you're doing is maybe unwinding, kind of. So it doesn't matter so much what kind of the effort you bring or the intention you bring. Or, you know, if you really want to get totally and fully enlightened, that's what you want to get, and you're striving and struggling to get that. The consequence of that kind of striving is not going to be noticeable maybe in half an hour or 40 minutes. But if you meditate all day for 3 or 4 or 5 days, then the attitude you have about meditation or the intention that you're trying to accomplish through your spiritual practice, the consequences of that become clearer and clearer. It's kind of like if your effort is a little off, if you're making too much effort, kind of straining effort, after 2 or 3 days of meditating, it becomes obvious. A certain kind of disequilibrium or certain kind of struggle or pain arises, frustration. Or if you're too complacent to your meditation and you're just kind of hanging out and just relaxing, well, that's fine for half an hour sitting because it's kind of relaxing to unwind. But try doing that in a longer meditation retreat, and probably you either end up falling asleep or being visited by sloth and torpor, or or it's, you know, it's just simply nothing much will happen. So one of the advantages of longer retreats is it kind of clarifies our intention by which we practice with. And so by the end of the 2 weeks, near the end, or after about 10 days or so, a lot of the ways in which people struggle with themselves or trying to avoid themselves by using meditation or trying to get something really special from meditation, all those kind of striving and struggling are put to rest. They're just kind of often seen through, and you relax, and you simply value just being present. And there's a kind of peacefulness that I think sets in through the room I don't know when it was, but at least after by the 10th day, there was this great, especially in the morning, this great calm and settledness in the room. There were a couple of people who were here. They were at the retreat. It's the end of struggle. And when a lot of this struggle is put to rest, there's a sense of maybe not even that you're the one who's meditating anymore, but rather that you're being meditated. And your meditation, your life of presence, seems then to exist in a much wider context than just your own personal effort and striving and struggle and what you can get from it. And some people, occasionally, people might even use the word state of grace, maybe, though that maybe is too strong a word for a lot of people. But there's a feeling of many people we've talked about touching something very precious in themselves, or precious, just the precious potential of presence. So 2 weeks ago, I talked a little bit about the wider context, one wider context for doing mindfulness practice in. And that was, I began talking about the triple refuge, the three treasures, the Buddha and Dharma and Sangha. And I wanted to continue talking about that a little bit today, because I think that at the end of a retreat, I think people can much more heartfeltly understand and want to express the wider context of their own life and other practice through, for example, the triple refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. We have these interview sheets that people fill out at the beginning of a retreat. And on the interview sheet, people write a little bit about what kind of practice they have at home, regular practice, what they've done in the past, what their spiritual practice is like. So, you know, I read through them at the beginning of the retreat. And one of the things that surprised me was there was not a lot of people, but a number of people who seemed to be into every possible spiritual endeavor you could find. They were, you know, I can't go through the list, but you know, they're sitting with this wonderful Indian guru, and they were doing this wonderful form of psychotherapy, and this wonderful form of Buddhist meditation practice, and this wonderful form of this, and this wonderful form of that, and they've been doing all these things for years, and it looks like very impressive credentials, but it just seems to be too much, and it's almost as if it's kind of the part of the consumer society, just kind of buying or acquiring or getting more. But what I felt, I mean, I don't know, I didn't necessarily interview these people, so I don't really know what was behind them. Maybe it was fine what they were, all their interests. But I think that to constantly be looking for more, or for something else, and more, and the better, and the best, and at some point, I think it goes in the opposite direction than the direction of spiritual practice is supposed to take you. I think a spiritual practice is about coming home and feeling content and at peace with oneself and with the world around one, so that one doesn't have to go out after the latest and greatest fad in spiritual supermarket in order to feel fulfilled, or in order to have more, or be better, or more worthy, or more adequate, or more enlightened, or whatever. That there is a kind of simplicity that sets in, that it's okay just to be who you are, maybe we can almost say. And maybe spiritual practice continues, and maybe just one practice, or maybe you do two practices, but something very, very simple. Because what is very important, I think, to distinguish between is self-improvement and spirituality. And a lot of people in our culture, I think, are caught on a treadmill of self-improvement. If you're trying to improve the self, there's never any end to it. And so it depends what then the motivation is for that improvement. But if the motivation comes from a sense of lack or inadequacy or ambition or whatever, chances are there's never any end to it. And people, there's often a distinction made between self-improvement and a spiritual practice. Because self-improvement, just the word self-improvement, is a little bit slightly suspicious in spiritual circles, especially Buddhist circles, where, you know, we don't have a self to improve. So what are we improving upon? And I think there's a place for many of the things maybe that fit under the category of self-improvement. And Buddhism itself is a kind of a therapy of sorts. So, but understanding our having a relationship to the triple treasures, I think, is one of the things that makes a Buddhist practice a spiritual practice, something that's more than just for your own individual self, but actually for a much wider context of our life. And I think that there's a spiritual life should, I would think, engage the various aspects of who we are. So the spiritual life, so there's an emotional level of our life. There's a, maybe we can call a rational level or cognitive level, an understanding level. And there's also a volitional level, intentional level, what we want, not only what we feel, and not only what we understand, but what we want to do, what we're motivated to do. And I think that it's possible to look at the triple treasures from those three different points of view, from emotional, rational, and volitional or intentional. And different people relate to the triple treasures in different ways, those three. I think for many people, the end of a long retreat or after many years of practice, the emotional level often is quite strong. There's often a feeling of tremendous gratitude or devotion towards, maybe just towards life or being awake and being present, but that gets channeled or gets expressed through a kind of reverence or deep respect for the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, for the carriers and containers for the practice that we have just done. And at the end, each evening, at the end of the day, we would chant the Triple Refuge, everyone together. And it became somehow, seemingly somehow spontaneously, or just somehow the way we all kind of were together, became very, I felt kind of loving, quiet, loving chant that we all did. For the people who stayed up late enough to do it. And people sometimes ask, well, where is the devotional aspect of Buddhism or Vipassana? And I think that it comes with time if you really let your heart become open. Different religions provide their participants, their members, or whatever, with symbols that help them understand their religious life. And there was a time in my life where I thought symbols were kind of extra and something that's, kind of you ignore symbols and just in favor for kind of direct involvement with life and participation in life and forget about symbols. But I've come to appreciate for myself personally the power of symbols. That symbols for me are one of the ways that symbols work, especially religious symbols, at least for myself, is that they are external manifestation of something that I feel within myself. And so to see it externally reminds me or resonates with something I discovered for myself. So it's kind of, I find it kind of wonderful to occasionally look at a Buddhist symbol or have symbols or be connected to kind of symbolic realm of existence or world. If you're into symbols, symbolic realms, you should get into Tibetan Buddhism. I mean, that's the Tibetan Buddhism itself is a symbolic system. Not just the elements of it. And maybe all religions are symbolic systems. But in Vipassana, especially when we look around us, what's the symbol here? We have the bell. But I think the Triple Refuge, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, has a symbolic function. Sometimes when I see certain Buddha images, are completely dead to me. There's no life in them. Nothing happens. But certain Buddha images come to life for me. And I've tried to understand what is it that is alive there for me. It's like there's a presence there. And usually for me, when I notice a living presence in a Buddha image, I'm usually looking at the chest. Like a place, maybe it's a place where, you breathe, where I breathe somehow. And so the chest and the abdominal, the whole torso. I don't look usually at the face that often, but it's at the torso. And that's what somehow, for me, and I think that somehow there's something about the statue which then resonates with some quality that I've discovered in myself, maybe through my own spiritual practice or my own meditation. And it's almost as if the artist has captured their meditation in the statue, and then it resonates then with my own. So it's a symbol out there, it's an external symbol, the Buddha. So what is the Buddha? What does this Buddha symbolize? And I think, the obvious thing is the Buddha symbolizes, or is, the historical Buddha, this fellow who lived 2,500 years ago, who then has been glorified ad infinitum by the Buddhist tradition. Since every religious tradition will take its founder, right, and deify him or her to the hilt. And the Buddhists have done that for sure. There's not much room left to do any more what some of the Buddhist traditions have done. But, he was a historical person. And how do we understand this historical person? And people try to read the texts and sutras and scriptures to see, who this person was. And And it's hard, you know, to wade through your way through scriptures because they're often written after the fact, sometimes hundreds of years after the fact. To get, it's hard, you know, it's hard enough with Jesus, you know. With Jesus, they have this gospel project now where they're trying to figure out what Jesus really said in the gospels. And it's really hard. You find a few sentences here that must have been said by him. But the gospels were written down 40 years after Jesus died. And it's so hard to figure out what's really his. The Buddha scriptures were written down 500 years after the Buddha died. So it's even harder. But what the Buddha is for me, I believe that he was a historical person. But for me, the Buddha symbolizes someone. There's a certain level of peace of mind, or deep sense of awakening, or deep sense of intimacy with life and the world around me, or deep sense of love or something. It may be said many different ways. Feeling of wholeness, completion, perfection. A state of mind or an experience of the heart, which I have tasted, that I've experienced, and I don't think it's anything rare. I think many people, or probably all of you at some point have tasted some kind of all-pervaded sense of peace that's kind of beyond anything you've imagined before. Maybe you can't put into words. And having tasted or felt something like that, what I imagine is that what I feel like must be the case is it's possible to have that experience so completely integrated and pervasive throughout one's being. And that a Buddha is someone who's done that. I mean, so I might have it occasionally, now and then. But because it's a potential that I have, I see that it's a potential that can grow and flower within me to include much more than just the few times that it's there. So I imagine that the Buddha is someone who has developed this potential that we have to the maximum degree. And I don't know what that maximum degree is. I don't want to idealize it. It's, you know, maybe it's, who knows? In the Zen tradition, they say that the Buddha is still living somewhere other than some mountain. He never died. And he's still practicing, but he's only halfway there, wherever there is. But so the Buddha represents this historical person, but also he symbolizes for me this potential that I feel that we all have, that we must have. So it represents in some ways that which is wisest within us, or the great capacity of the heart to love, to have compassion. And I find myself inspired by that symbol or that representation of that potential. And the more I've kind of been able to taste something like it, the more I get inspired by it. And sometimes when I see a Buddha image, I want to bow to it. Because, as Suzuki Roshi said, when you bow to the Buddha image, you're really bowing to yourself. And then there's a Dharma. So in some ways, the Buddha then is the potential that we have. Then there's the Dharma. And the Dharma is understood as many different things. It's most simply, it's the teaching of the Buddha or the Buddha Dharma. But it's also said to be things as they are. And things as they are is a Dharma. Not so much, you know, our abstractions about things or interpretations we lay on top of things, but to really see reality, the events of reality, as they are, they say in Buddhism. That's the Dharma. And that involves understanding or seeing some of the underlying laws or patterns of reality. And it also involves seeing that when the mind is present and awake to things as they are, there's a level of trust in the universe that's possible. But as the Dharma is things as they are, and that's what we're seeing, that's what we're also taking refuge in, then things as they are not always so nice. Right? So taking refuge in the Buddha is taking refuge in this wonderful idealistic potential. Taking refuge in the Dharma is taking refuge to, you know, this world that we find ourselves in, and this personality, and this body that decays and falls apart as we get older and older, and this mind which is neurotic and you know, and you know, all this stuff that we have. So today, you know, so I was up there on Skyline near Jokoji, which is south of Page Mill Road, and it was getting dark, and my battery went completely dead. And so I tried to roll down the hill, but it was so dead it wouldn't even start. And finally, where I kind of parked off, I found a place to park, was underneath these trees, you know, it was even darker. So, and, you know, and I was supposed to be down here in an hour and a half or so, and to, you know, what do you do when you're up there in the middle of it, on the mountains without a battery? And luckily, there was a woman who was, had been the same place I was, who was driving by, and so she helped me. And so what do we do? You know, do we come down here and buy a battery? And if we buy a battery, then how do I get it back up again? You know, and any of you willing to drive me all the way back up there? It's an hour from here, up in the mountains, you know, at 9 o'clock. And am I going to be stuck down here or go stay in a hotel? Probably one of you put me up, but still my car's up there and I'm down here. And, you know, what's, you know, and then, so finally we're driving back to Skylanda and there's a gas station there. We asked the gas station if they had an extra battery, and the Mexican-American who didn't speak much English pointed to the triple C batteries hanging. Do you have any batteries? And he pointed. I said, car battery. And so he called the owner, and the owner came out, and he said, no, we don't have any new batteries. And I said, well, do you have an old one I can borrow? And, to my amazement, he just gave it to me. He didn't give it to me. He lent me a battery, a used battery. And then he lent me the wrench. I was just, you know, it doesn't happen so often. And so then, so I was going away with it, and I said, well, shouldn't I leave a deposit or something? And you're bringing it back tomorrow, aren't you? Yeah. No need then. And this time, you know, so I was glad for that. But the battery he gave me, he couldn't guarantee that it worked. And the woman drove really slow, so it was like a half an hour back to where my car was, and we didn't know if the battery was going to work. And then, by this time, I was really famished. I really hadn't had much lunch, and I was getting kind of weak and a headache and all this stuff. And we get back to my car, and I was trying to take off my battery cables, and they're completely, one of them is completely corroded, almost to nothing. And there was nothing really to take out. I couldn't get it off. You know, I tried and tried, and it looked like I was going to maybe break the battery because it was like, and so, but finally, it came loose. And then we put the new battery in, and it worked. So that's the Dharma. I still had a headache and was famished. And so what would it mean to take refuge in all that? I mean, and I was late. I knew all these people were going to be down here waiting for me to give a talk and to sit with you all. I wanted to sit with you all. And you know, get down here. And I didn't know if I would ever get down here or what. I didn't know anything. And so what does it mean to take refuge in the Dharma as things as they are with that? Was it okay to have things go wrong? And it was okay to have things go wrong. I mean, I tried my best to figure out how to do, but I figured that, I mean, it wasn't even any figuring. I mean, what could I do? It was what it was. So why get anxious? So I tried not to get anxious. And I didn't get too anxious until I went into Skylanda Market there. I was so hungry. I finally wanted to get something to eat, and they had closed. So what does it take refuge? So there's the potential, there's the ideal, which is maybe represented by the Buddha, and there's things as they are, which is represented by the Dharma. And what does it take refuge in these two things? And is it possible? Is it interesting? Do any of you really want to take refuge in things as they are? You know, or are you trying your best not to? Are you, you know, you prefer the Buddha? So you don't have to look at the Dharma? Is that how you know what it's about? I think a lot of people involved in spiritual traditions, that's what they're doing. They're kind of looking at towards the Buddha so they can not deal with the Dharma, with things as they are, just really see it and be with it. But actually, my feeling is that if you have a choice between relating to the ideal or the actual, you should always choose the actual. And you should find the ideal through the actual not by avoiding the actual. So, and actually the Buddha said once, there was this fellow who, this monk who was enamored with the Buddha, and would just follow him around everywhere and listen to every word he had to say, and just, even when the Buddha wasn't speaking, he would just sit there kind of gazing in rapt attention or love or something and looking at this, the Buddha. And finally the Buddha got kind of, annoyed, I guess, or this is enough now or something. And the Buddha said to him, among various things, but he said to him, the one who sees the Dharma sees the Buddha. The one who sees the Dharma sees the Buddha. And this is an expression then, which is one of the few kind of expressions which is found in almost all schools of Buddhism. Certain teachings from the early stages of Buddhism were kept intact throughout the Buddhism, and that particular one, person who sees the Dharma sees the Buddha. And what does it mean to really see the Dharma, things as they are? Pesha, do you need an answer?
Yeah, I'm struggling with sometimes in situations, I know what the ideal would be for me to do, and what the right thing to do, but that's not how I feel.
Yeah.
The way I feel, maybe I'm more of mean or nasty or, territorial.
Uh-huh.
But so looking at the Dharma, what is so, the way I feel.
Uh-huh. Yes.
But the ideal is out there, the potential is there. Wouldn't I like to be the better way?
It's very dangerous to have an ideal, And it can be an inspiration, and it can be a refuge. It can give you some solace or some hope or some refuge to know that there's a potential that we have that we can maybe find or rest in or develop into. However, it becomes very dangerous when you set up the ideal as something that you're going to grasp after, or that you're going to use to avoid the present. So if you don't like being mean, and there's tremendous aversion to that, and the expression of that aversion is clinging to the ideal, or trying to get to the ideal, that's neither Dharma or Buddha. I think to take refuge in your meanness means to see it really clearly, but not to buy into it. To see it, this is the reality. What's happening is, this is what's happening in the universe right now. This particular corner of the universe, it's evolved after some, what is it? How old is the universe?
Whatever.
Many billions of years.
10 to 12.
And it's just 10 or 12 billion years.
give or take.
It's a long time. And it's quite, it's kind of come together in this little corner, after all those billions of years, and all these 5 billion people in this world, here we have this moment of meanness. Isn't that phenomenal? That's the Dharma. Now, what you do about that, that's a whole other ballpark. But take refuge in the Dharma is simply to see it and let it be. And find some way that not only seeing it and letting it be is a good thing to do, but I think it can be a religious thing to do. You can actually see your meanness and feel, by connecting to it, to be connected to a religious sentiment or world or spiritual sense. Because it's the Dharma. It's things as they are. This is how 12 billion years has come to this. And 12 billion years, that's pretty, there'll be 12 billion years after it also. So that's, mostly tonight what I'm giving you maybe is a koan rather than an answer. What does it mean to take refuge? And I think each person, if you're interested in these kind of more, this is like the common denominator of Buddhism. All the different schools of Buddhism take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is a common denominator among all of them. It's like really the simplest expression of being a Buddhist or being involved in Buddhism, kind of a spiritual tradition. So if you're interested in this, then the task is not to memorize what I might say about it, but to find out for yourself, what does it mean to go for refuge? To find a refuge, to find a wider container for our life in these three things, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Yes?
In dealing with my cat Sophie's serious kidney failure,
and hydrating her twice a day and having a vet who feels he wants to continue as long as she's eating a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm struggling with accepting the reality of what I'm dealing with, although sometimes I flip into outcome, the fear of losing her. But I'm trying very much to stay present with the process of my giving to her as long as she's with me. So, in working with the Dharma, is this something, does it sound like I'm sort of...
Well, when I had my car problem, which is, you know, a much simpler thing, I did my, you know, I felt I had a responsibility to show up here tonight. So I did my best thing I could do, I have to figure out to try to come down here. But I wasn't so really concerned about the outcome. I mean, I was doing my very best thing I could figure out how to get the car fixed and come down here. But it was okay with me if I didn't. It was okay with me if I didn't show up. It had to be because I might not have shown up. So I think with it's much more difficult when it's someone who you love. And so again, you can do your best. We do the best we can, using our common sense and whatever, and knowing that even doing our best is not enough sometimes to save a life, and that it has to be okay for our loved ones to die and pass away. Something has to be okay about it. I mean, not that it's not... Being okay doesn't mean that it's not painful. But feeling pain is part of life. And pain is sometimes the Dharma. But what we don't want to do is complicate it by then feeling self-pity on top of our pain. Or feeling guilt because, you know, maybe I could have done a little bit better, or feeling, you know, all these kinds of things, judgments we add on top of it, and build this whole universe of stuff that adds all this pain. To take refuge in the Dharma of loss is just allow the pain to be there and not create into anything more. So, I mean, it's not easy. Your dilemma you're in is not easy, but you know, do your best you can. And when your best you can is not enough, be willing to let go. There was this woman on the retreat who has a brain tumor, and she had it operated on, taken out 5 years ago when I first met her. And then it looked like maybe the operation was successful. And now it's something, it wasn't clear what was happening, but it seemed like it was growing back. She was a young woman, maybe under 30. And you could tell that something serious was going on, because now she was losing her balance and would shuffle along, and she slurred her speech, and she was losing her memory. But she said at one point, "You know, I'm losing my memory, and all I can do is really be in the moment. And it's so nice to be in the spiritual tradition where that's okay." But you know, the Dharma, what is it? So that's the question. I'm not offering so much an answer tonight, but asking you to reflect, what does it mean to take refuge in things as they are? How do we relate to things as they are, that you find a refuge there, that you find an end of struggle or end of strife or guilt or conflict at least? And then the last is take refuge in Sangha. And Thich Nhat Hanh is supposed to have said that the next Buddha will be the Sangha. And I think that often in our culture, in the West, that we tend to stress much more the Buddha and the Dharma than we do the Sangha. And these three at least make a tripod. And if one of the legs of the tripod is not there, it'll fall down. Take refuge in the Sangha. And traditionally, that's kind of meant to take refuge kind of in the support and inspiration you can get from the people around you who are also practicing a spiritual life or a Buddhist life or whatever. And I think it was someone at the retreat, maybe Eugene, I think it was Eugene or someone talked, someone said that he takes inspiration in the fact that whenever he sits down to meditate, he never meditates alone. That somewhere in the world, there are other people also meditating at the same time. Let alone the world, just, you know, probably just in California. I guess even the peninsula. Anytime you're going to sit down, there's probably at least one other person who's going to be meditating at the same time. And Eugene found some inspiration from that. And I find some inspiration by that. You know, it's not something you do alone. So the Sangha is, you know, is a support and an inspiration. It's also the field for practice, a very important field for practice. That sanghas are, as far as I can tell, sanghas, Buddhist communities, are never ideal. There's always something not ideal about them, and to varying degrees. And so sometimes people forget that you never find the ideal sangha. And it's nice to read the stories from the Buddha's lifetime. And the things that his monks did. Boy, I mean, they were wild. Outrageous behavior. And, you know, we were so civilized. And teach those who are teachable. Buddha can't teach anybody, everyone. Only the ones, those who are teachable. So sanghas aren't ideal, but they're not supposed to be, I think. That what they are is also a place where we interact with each other. And in the interactions, the stuff that comes up becomes the practice. And you know, we get irritated or angry with each other or whatever. And so we get to see all that, and we get to explore it. And hopefully to take refuge in the Sangha means to find that a possibility to work with the difficulties of being in a community that are different than the way you work with it outside, in a kind of normal society where maybe there isn't much permission to do that. And I like to believe that a Sangha, members of Sangha, are people who, if there is an interpersonal conflict or difficulty, are not going to turn away or reject anyone, but are going to hang in there and try to work things out. So it's maybe safer to be a little bit, you know, unusual, or to have a little, you know, you don't have to be so protective of yourself, and try to always be the ideal or perfect person. Because a Sangha is a place, hopefully it's okay to kind of relax a little bit and express who you are, and then make that the practice. And then the last thing I'll say to end is that Sangha is very, very important. And a lot of the learning that can happen from a spiritual life and a lot of the development that can happen come from the Sangha itself, more so than books or teachers or something like that. And I want to encourage you all to, especially those of you who come in any kind of regular basis, to try to get to know each other a little bit. And not only because, you know, there'll be some difficulty you can work with, you know, probably, but I think more, but maybe even more important, I think that you share something really precious in common, and to be able to appreciate together, and to be, find support together, and to explore together this very precious thing of awakening, of being present. Adds a great richness to a person's practice and to one's life. And I think that the benefits of hanging out with each other are great. And there's been a few people who have invited different groups, different people randomly, or I don't know how it happens, to their homes for dinner or for lunch, and just to kind of hang out and get to know each other. And I feel like it's a little bit odd for me to make that kind of suggestion, but because it's suggesting something you do in your private life. But I would encourage you. I think it's really nice. then maybe invite people who you've seen regularly but never talked to. Or whatever. Judith.
I wanted to offer a little chance for Sangha practice this weekend. We'll be working on the grounds of the meeting here on Saturday morning. Again, there'll be pancakes at 8:30. The hard work until about 12:30. And the bits of equipment that we especially need are some 8-foot ladders and people who would like to lead, who've got a lot of leading to do this time, and some pruning. And you're very welcome to come. And the last time we found that it was particularly nice was a chance to speak to people from meeting from the Sangha, and people from the Sangha working with each other too. It's just a perfect
great. Well, thank
illustration
you.
Of just what you're speaking about.
Mm-hmm. And it is nice to help. We sometimes I suspect we use this building more than the Quakers do.
They're beginning to.
And so maybe it's nice if we also help take care of it.
Yeah.
Yes.
I just want to remind people that the potluck is on the 18th of
the
week. That's an
opportunity. Great. So I hope you find it interesting, perhaps, to reflect on what it means to take refuge in these three things. And I said 2 weeks ago, I think, that we're in a strange tradition where, religious tradition, where you're not supposed to really identify too much with being part of the tradition. You know, being a Buddhist is not where it's at exactly. But in any case, the simplest way of being a Buddhist is to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The definition of someone who's a Buddhist is someone who's taking refuge in those. So thank you all, and I wish you all well. See you next week.